my gran asked, dreading a long night of looking over maps.
No, Ariana laughed. And it doesn't have to be you. I don't want to take you away from your duties. I also don't want to wait until I have a crown on my head to learn the tasks of being queen.
That is wise, Your Highness, my gran thought for a moment. Who to assign the delicate task of teaching Ariana military strategy? A delicate, likely frustrating task, but one that could be rewarding, if the future queen thought well of the person.
I have a young man in mind, a Captain Radic. He's a distant relative of the Magnicos. A promising young officer, in my opinion. He will be available, here in the castle, until springtime.
And, my gran thought sourly, perhaps all year, if the fickle regent refused to send the royal army into the field once winter was over.
Good. Have this Captain Radic speak with my secretary soon. Now, General, my personal guards were with me all spring and summer. They must be tired, and in need of retraining. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Highness,
my gran answered warily, wondering why the princess had asked.
They will be reporting for training in a fortnight, and be replaced by fresh men from the castle guard.
The Thralrun Woods are an excellent place for training, don't you think?
She asked with a slight smile.
The Thrall... Your Highness, forgive me, but your mother...
Commands the royal army. She does not command my personal guard. Since Mother won't send rangers to help Yaren secure the Thralrun, I am sending my own guard there. For rest and training, of course. I think 30 men from my personal guard should help Yaren sleep better at night, with his border more secure.
Ariana could not help smiling. She was well pleased with herself for outmaneuvering her mother. My gran could not help smiling, behind his beard. Ariana Trehaime was going to be a formidable queen. The general only hoped he would survive the next few years to see her safely on the throne. The morning of Ariana's garden party started extra early for Corrin. First, he grabbed a quick breakfast for himself, a small loaf of freshly baked bread, a sausage, and hot tea. Then he fed and exercised Thunderbolt, and back to the wizard's tower. Pedrus didn't drink tea in the mornings. He drank coffee. Many of the army soldiers drank coffee in the mornings. They said it made them more alert. Corrin had heard of coffee before, but never seen it. It was too expensive for most people. Even tea was too dear for many poor farm families. Pedrus had coffee beans brought in especially from his homeland twice a year. They were stored in metal pails in the root cellar to keep them cool. Corrin needed to scoop out enough for a week to keep in the tower's pantry, and each morning he carefully roasted a small handful of beans, ground them, and slowly poured boiling hot water over the grinds. The wizard liked his coffee strong, with a spoon of cream stirred in. Once the coffee was ready, Corrin put the pot on the side of the stove to keep it hot, but not too hot, and he ran over to the royal kitchens to fetch breakfast for the wizard. With the breakfast in a covered tray, which also went on the side of the stove, he put on an apron and crept up the stairs to listen whether the wizard was awake yet. That morning, the wizard was up, puttering around in his laboratory. So Corrin dashed down the stairs and delivered breakfast, which was suitably appreciated. Pedrus did not trust the royal kitchens to prepare his precious coffee. He had painstakingly shown Corrin how to roast, grind, and brew the bitter liquid, and exactly at what temperature it should be served. To the wizard's delight, Corrin brewed perfect coffee. Knowing his servant had a busy day ahead, the wizard said Corrin could clean up the dishes later. Gratefully, Corrin ran back down the stairs to run the wizard's bathwater and stoked the water heater stove. He had taken a bath the evening before, so now he got dressed in the party clothes that Ariana's maid had delivered the previous afternoon. The maid had even shown Corrin how to wear the clothes, which was helpful,
for he had no idea whether the shirt was supposed to be tucked into the pants or not, and whether the pants should be tucked into the boots. Yes to both questions. He was dressed and ready an hour before the party was to start. Plenty of time to duck back into the kitchens and scrounge up something more to eat. And borrow an apron so he wouldn't drip strawberry jam onto his new jacket.
Ariana's party to open the new garden maze was, in Kaya's words, a smashing success. The weather was perfect, a brilliantly clear late autumn day, unseasonably warm.
At Ariana's request, the royal gardener had been working on growing the maize for 3 years. The thick hedges occupied almost an acre of land in a garden outside the walls of the castle. Stone planters held some of the hedges, which could be moved to change the path of the maze, so Ariana and her guests would not get bored with it. There were 3 entrances, all eventually leading to the center, with many complicated dead ends along the way. Ariana set up 3 teams of 3. With her were Corin and a girl who was the daughter of some baron. Kaya led one of the other teams. At the blare of a trumpet, the teams were off, running headlong down the maze. It took almost a quarter of an hour, but in the end, Ariana triumphantly led her team to the center, just ahead of Kaya. Corin could not remember the last time he had so much fun. Afterward, there was a picnic on the great lawn of the garden, with kites to fly, games of kickball, and much general racing about and tomfoolery that the children's royal parents certainly would not have approved of. But that didn't matter, for Ariana hadn't invited any adults. And she said so. On the advice of Niles Fawn, Kaya did not act as though the princess were his new best friend. In fact, he rather left her alone. It was Corin who brought them together, choosing Kaya to play on Ariana's kickball team without asking her first. The princess seemed cool to the idea, but Kaya was a good sport, even when he was knocked out of the game, and laughed and joked around so easily, Ariana had to wonder whether her opinion of Kyle Falco, as devious and scheming, was entirely correct. After the fireworks that closed the party, Ariana went back to her royal apartments, Corin went to the wizard's tower, and Kaya reported to Niles Fawn that the day had been another triumph for the Falcos. While Corin enjoyed Ariana's party, and Kaya tried to impress the young princess, Pedras had invited Grand General Magran to discuss recent information Magran had received from his spy network, although that was really just an excuse to talk about future army strategy. Or, rather, what future army strategy should be if the regent had been willing to listen to either her army commander or her chief wizard. The general climbed the stairs with head held high, shoulders back, standing proud and tall. When he reached the study where Pedras was waiting, he dismissed his 2 guards to wait by the tower's front door, and slumped wearily into a chair by the fireplace.
"Oh, Pedras, I am tired to the core of my bones. Perhaps I'm too old for this."
The wizard picked up the coffee pot from the side of the metal stove and poured a mug for his guest.
"Nonsense, Leon," he said,
returning the general's informality by using the man's first name.
"You're in your prime, commanding the entire royal army, and you're younger than me."
"Ah," Magran sighed as he sipped from the hot mug. "That is good coffee. You may be older in years than I am, but you are a wizard, after all."
"A wizard, yes. But having a longer life sometimes means having more than one lifetime of aches and pains. I dread the winters here. They make my joints ache. If it is going to rain, I can tell because my knees hurt, and that's no wizardry."
"We've earned our aches and pains, Pedras, from long service and too many nights sleeping on the cold ground. Aye, that too."
Pedras poured a mug of coffee for himself, and reached for a scroll the general had brought.
"Where is that confounded glass?"
"Oh!"
He realized he'd been sitting on it all morning.
"Here it is."
He unrolled the scroll, which was written painstakingly in a cipher by the spy who had sent it to Magran. The general had men who could decipher the document, one letter at a time, but Pedrus had no patience for that. He held the glass, a thick, flat disc of clear glass, over the scroll, and looked through it. Because of the spell the wizard had cast on the glass, the words of the scroll appeared in plain writing to his eye. He frowned.
"This is not quite the good news we had hoped for, I am afraid."
Magran snorted.
"Who hoped for good news? I didn't. About the war, about our fortunes, there is no good news. Nor will there ever be." "Come, Leon. Surely you don't mean that."
"Pedrus, we are men of action and responsibility. You and I, here in private, need not tell each other happy fairy tales. We are losing this war. We have been losing for the last 200 or so years. Our late king, and a few other kings and queens, may have halted our decline for a time, but year by year, our enemy grows stronger, and we do not. Our allies waver, those who have not already declared themselves neutral, or fallen under the sway of our enemy. I do not blame them, those smaller kingdoms, for if we cannot guarantee their protection, they must act to protect themselves. We know Le Monde allows pirates sponsored by Isidore to use two of their islands as a base to raid our merchant ships.
Le Monde was a small, independent duchy at the eastern end of a large island off Tarador's southern shore. For centuries, part of Tarador's Royal Navy had been based in Le Monde's fine harbor. For 30 years ago, Tarador had found the expense of maintaining a large navy, stationing hundreds of Royal Army troops in Le Monde and paying an annual fee to the Duchess for use of the harbor, to be unsustainable. So, the troops had been withdrawn, the ships returned to Tarador, and the payments stopped. The Duchess had begged for at least 2 ships and 100 soldiers, a token force at best, to remain. Harbor fees would stop. Indeed, the Duchess offered to pay for the supplies the Royal Army troops needed. But the king who ruled Tarador at the time, struggling to deal with a drought, crop failures, and orcs raiding across the northern provinces, declared Tarador could no longer afford to support Le Monde. 3 months after the Royal Navy ships departed for home, the Duchess of Le Monde received a notice that Isidore would be sending an envoy, and she would be wise to allow the envoy's ship into her harbor. Since then, 2 of Le Monde's strategically placed islands had, essentially, been ceded to Isidore. It had been a major defeat for Tarador, and the kingdom had been paying the price ever since. Allies learned from Le Monde that Tarador could not be relied on. Magran gulped the remains of his coffee, which was growing cold, made a sour face, and continued.
"Without allies, without committed allies, we are alone. Alone, we cannot hope to stand against Isidore. Even powerful nations like Indus now refuse to extend us credit to buy supplies we need for our survival. They insist on being paid with gold, lest Isidore overwhelm us before we can pay our creditors. I fear that Ariana will be the last ruler of Tarador, and my fear, my lack of faith in our future, makes me unable to properly fulfill my duty to our future queen. A general who sees no hope of victory cannot lead an army. I intend to resign at the end of this year."
Pedrus was greatly alarmed. Grand General Magran was his best ally against the regent, one of the few people of sufficient stature to make Carlana listen, who agreed with Pedrus about the need to take action against the enemy. Mostly, The two men had argued fruitlessly with the regent, but Pedrus had hoped to change that soon.
"General, I can understand your despair. Please remember."
Pedrus held his left hand open, and a searing, bright ball of fire briefly lit up the room. "That we have significant power on our side also."
Magrand blinked to clear his vision, seeing an afterimage of the fireball dancing in front of his eyes.
"Pedrus, I know you are a powerful wizard, perhaps the most powerful wizard in the land, but even you—" "No. I—"
Pedrus caught himself before he revealed the truth.
Not even Grand General Magrand could know about Corrin. Carlana was safely within the castle, while Magrand went into the field with the army, where he might be captured. Captured and given to an enemy wizard, who would strip the general's mind open and reveal any secrets his mind held.
"I do not despair. There are certain reasons, known only to wizards, why our fortunes will change dramatically for the better during Ariana's reign, within a very few years."
Magrand looked up sharply at the wizard.
"You speak truthfully, not merely providing comfort to an old man. Soon, other members of the Wizard's Council will arrive here in Linden to make plans for the future."
Pedrus leaned forward in his chair, elbows on his knees.
"Believe me," he said,
as he added just a hint of reassuring magic behind his words,
"this nation will survive. Leon, for the first time since I journeyed across the sea to pledge my services to our long struggle against the enemy, I can see the end of this war, within not just my lifetime, but yours."
Pedrus truly believed his words. The wizard held out his hand.
"Keep your boots on, General. Your nation needs you."
Magrand nodded. He had not wanted to resign, and whether he completely believed the wizard or not, he could see the wizard believed.
He took the wizard's hand in a strong grip and shook it.
"I know better than to ask for the secrets of wizards, but agreed. We'll see this through to the end, you and I."
"Excellent. More coffee?" "Corrin? Corrin? Now where is that boy?"
"Oh, there you are,"
the wizard announced as Corrin stepped breathlessly through the doorway, having run up two flights of stairs as quickly as he could.
"I need to send this message to Duke Magnico. Run this,"
he held out a rolled-up scroll of paper,
"over to the telegraph."
Corrin got a pained expression on his face, which the wizard failed to notice, as he had already turned his attention back to the bubbling glass containers on the laboratory workbench.
"Telegriff? What is a griff? And what was Corrin supposed to tell it?"
Sir, what is a griff?"
This got the astonished wizard's attention.
"A griff?"
"Yes, sir. You wanted me to tell a griff something."
Corrin assumed whatever he was to tell the griff was on the scroll. Pedrus chuckled softly. It had not occurred to him that Corrin Bladewell, farm boy from tiny Krebs Ford, had no idea what a telegraph was.
"Not telegriff, a telegraph. It is a series of towers across Tarador, with one visible from the next, to carry messages. You must have seen one atop the hill to the east of the city. The office here is at Army Headquarters, across the courtyard."
Corrin had indeed seen the tower with the strange-looking contraption on top, wooden arms, somewhat like a windmill, only, instead of sails, the arms had flags.
"Is that what the tower is for, sir?"
"Yes, it is quite clever. I had never seen one before I came to Tarador," the wizard admitted. "The position of the arms and the type of flags spell out words. At night,
Colored lanterns are used, rather than flags. The first part of each message tells whom the message is from. The next part tells who the message is addressed to. Then, the actual message. Most royal or army messages are put into code to keep them secret. There are such towers throughout Tarador, connecting Linden to each of the provincial capitals, and some of the dukes have their own telegraph lines to connect them directly. With the telegraph system, a message can cross the nation from southeast to northwest in a single day, depending on weather, of course. Fog, rain, or snow can block the view from one tower to the next.
That is amazing, sir!
Corrin was truly impressed. He'd never imagined such a thing. Twice in his life, he had seen couriers riding fast horses through Krebs Ford, headed toward the Baron's castle. He assumed all messages traveled by courier on horseback. How else could it be?
But, I thought you sent messages by, magic or something. Like that hawk last week.
A hawk had flown to the windowsill and pecked at the window glass until the wizard let it in and retrieved a small message scroll that was tied to the bird's leg.
Oh, yes. The army also uses pigeons. They are trained to fly to one place, like the royal palace, from wherever they are released. The problem, you see, is that a pigeon can only fly to one place, which is not convenient. And pigeons, of course, can fall prey to falcons.
But the hawk, sir?
Oh, the hawk. That was magic. I told the hawk to find a merchant I know. The man, well, he lives by the coast and keeps an eye out for enemy agents around our ports. This merchant moves around quite a bit, so I couldn't send a message to a fixed address.
How did the hawk find him, sir?
Huh? Oh.
Sometimes Pedras forgot how even simple magic wasn't obvious to ordinary people.
You see, I put a picture in the hawk's mind, what the merchant looks like. Hawks have exceptional eyes, of course. And I also told the hawk several places the merchant might be. That, is rather odd. For birds don't see the world the way we do. They navigate by the position of the sun, and along invisible lines of energy. I don't know how to explain it. It is disturbing, that type of magic. So be in an animal's mind, however briefly. But it might not work anyway, except that I have a piece of cloth with the merchant's scent on it. Those little metal boxes I keep in the cupboard. Each one has a cloth with a person's scent on it. The hawk delivers my message, then waits for a reply message to be tied to its leg, and returns to me.
I was wondering what those little boxes were, sir.
Invisible lines of energy. The world of wizards would truly be forever beyond Corrin's comprehension. Ah, so what? It wasn't anything he needed to know as the wizard servant.
I will carry your message to the telegraph office right away, sir.
While Kaer Falco was still glowing from the day, the party to open the maze was not quite a triumph for Corrin. Servants in the castle had started whispering as soon as they saw Corrin get out of the royal carriage on the return from Levan. Corrin had gotten out of the carriage before it went through the castle gate, because Carlana was sure there would be a scandal if a young man were seen with the princess at the palace. Still, enough people saw Corrin get out of the carriage, saw him wearing nice, clean clothes, and saw the princess lean out of the carriage, waving to him as the carriage drove through the gate. Then, the servant who brought to Corrin the invitation to have lunch with the princess had told a few people, who told other people, who told other people. Word got around that this new boy, a poor, uneducated farm boy, a commoner whose lot in life was to clean up after the wizard, this boy was putting on airs. thinking he was better than the other servants. It was bad enough that Corrin was invited to the palace to dine with the princess. When Corrin was invited to the grand party that opened the royal maze, a party where a large number of servants were there working properly as servants, while Corrin cavorted and ran around and laughed and ate fine food with the royalty right in front of the servants, well, clearly something had to be done to put the new boy back in his place. Bart Loman didn't have the best of luck. What he had imagined when he thought of showing this Corrin Bladewell his proper place in the castle was for Corrin to be dressed in the fancy clothes he wore when he visited the palace to dine with the princess, where he no doubt drank tea from fine crystal cups with his pinky finger in the air. Bart had imagined Corrin smelling of flowery perfume, having his hair cleaned, combed, and tied back in a fancy ribbon. The picture should have been of Corrin striding across the courtyard, nose in the air, looking down on all the other servants. What Bart Loman got instead was Corrin, having exercised, fed, and brushed Thunderbolt, and then worked for an hour in the stables hauling hay bales and mucking out stalls to pay for the horse's keep, walking back to the wizard's tower bent low under a load of firewood slung over his shoulders. He was an old, patched and dirty second-hand clothing, his hair tangled with bits of hay stuck in it, and he smelled, well, he smelled like what his second-hand boots had stepped in at the stables. Bart chewed on his lip while he thought. The gang of servants he had gathered looked at him, questioningly. Corrin was supposed to be having lunch with the princess, in the palace, like he had done on the first day of the week for the past month. Why was he looking and working like a common servant? Working, in fact, harder than Bart Loman ever did, since Bart preferred shirking to working. Bart's personal motto was, in fact, "Why work when you can shirk?" Bart didn't know that the regent had declared her daughter needed to spend her time studying the history and customs of the Indus Empire, which was sending a new ambassador to Tarador soon. So Ariana had no time for lunches with Corrin. Seeing Corrin working so hard didn't make Bart reconsider his plans. It only made him grit his teeth in anger. Not only was the new boy dining with royalty above his station, he was now also making other servants look bad. "Come on, boys, let's show 'em how things are done around here." Bart glanced around, looking for guards, then strode out into the courtyard, leading his gang of a dozen servants. Bart stepped in front of Corrin, blocking his path, while the others surrounded the tired young man. Corrin knew this was trouble. He had seen Bart around the castle. The other boy was 15, almost 16, tall and big for his age. Bart's straight black hair was pulled back like the way soldiers wore their hair, and the expression on his face was anything but friendly. He had a reputation as a bully, and Corrin had avoided him. But that wouldn't work now. With a sigh, Corrin set the firewood down behind him. "Hey, you're Bart, aren't you?"
"Aye, that's my name, your lordship," Bart said in a sneering voice as he bowed mockingly. "Surprised you know the name of a lowly servant, your lordship being all high and mighty and dining in the palace with the princess."
"I'm not a lord, I'm a servant," Corrin protested. "The wizard's servant," he added, knowing that most people feared Pedras.
"Aye, a servant when you have to be, when you're not putting on your fancy clothes and dining with the princess, and having her show you around the palace like you're picking out which room you want for yourself. Being a servant like us isn't good enough for you. You're better than the likes of us here."
Bart glanced at the other boys, seeing with satisfaction that his words had hit home. They were nodding and muttering and shaking fists at Corrin. Bart kept going before Corrin could answer.
and you spreading fairy tales about how you're a hero, saving the princess from a bear and a pack of wolves and half the Isildur army, and then you sprouted wings and flew her to safety. Bart got a good laugh from his boys from that joke. What really happened that day, Sir Corrin the Brave? Oh, I forgot. You didn't get a knighthood.
It was Corrin's turn to grit his teeth. As much as he wanted to tell Bart that he had saved the princess, not once but three times, while the princess's personal guards had floundered uselessly in the water, he had promised Paedras that he would stick to the agreed story. She fell into the water when the boat flipped over.
Ha! Bart scoffed. What I hear is you fell into the water, tripped over your own feet and fell in, and she rescued you. Sounds a lot more likely a story, right, boys? Or you want us to believe the fairy tales about you scaring away a bear and a pack of bandits?
All the servants laughed at that.
You know what else I hear? Bart continued. I hear you're a jinx. You're cursed.
Cursed. And there must be a reason for a curse like that. Don't happen for no reason.
What did you do to get a curse like that?
I'm not a jinx. Paedras says there's no such thing. Bart shook his head slowly.
Boys, he's as gullible as he is stupid. Course the wizard told you you're not a jinx. Told you what you want to hear, he did. Why you think he's got you living in his tower? So he can keep an eye on you and stop your curse from hurting anyone else, that's why. It's plain as the nose on your face to anyone else. You're too dumb to see the truth.
Corrin paused, mouth open. He had been thinking of a good insult to throw at Bart, but the other boy's words struck him. There was a ring of truth to what Bart said. The wizard had only offered to let Corrin live with him after Corrin told him about being a terrible, dangerous jinx. Bart laughed and pointed at Corrin.
Look at that mouth open! A mouth like that needs a hook in it, doesn't it, fishy?
Shut up, was all Corrin could think to say in return. Any clever insults had temporarily left his brain. Bart was encouraged by Corrin's obvious anger.
And here's another thing. Your parents abandoned you. I don't blame them. Any ungrateful son like you deserves to get dumped in the woods.
I'm not ungrateful, Corrin shot back hotly.
Oh, no. Your family was forced out of their home because of you. You caused all the trouble, you stinking cursed jinx.
The decent thing to do was for you to run away by yourself and not make your parents leave their home because of you.
I didn't... Corrin didn't know what to say. Admit it. You didn't care about your
Bart's thought was cut off when a hand grabbed the back of his shirt collar and yanked him back roughly.
Bart, Cully said as he released hold of the other boy's shirt collar. You making trouble again with your pack of ruffians? Shirking when you should be working? Stay out of this, Cully,
Bart warned. Cully, I can fight my own battles, Corrin said. But Bart's words about how he should have run away and saved his parents from being exiled, that stung him badly. He didn't have much fight left in him. Cully edged sideways to stand next to Corrin.
Yeah, but you doesn't always have to fight your battles alone. Should have told you about old Bart here, the big lummox. He don't like to see anyone working round the castle. Makes him look bad. I'm warning you, Cully, Bart shouted as he raised his fists, looking around the courtyard to judge whether it was safe, for the moment, to get into a brawl. And I'm warning you, Bart Lummox, that I've thumped you before, and I'll thump you again.
Cully stood his ground, not afraid of the bigger boy.
Now, you get out of here, or I'll thump you bad enough, you'll be shirking in the hospital.
Bart took a step back. Cully had thumped him before, twice before. The smaller boy was surprisingly fast, and Cully fought dirty. Bart saw the stricken look on Corrin's face and knew he had hurt the wizard's brat badly enough with his words. Fists weren't needed.
and trouble would only get Bart assigned more working and less shirking.
Bah! Bart scoffed with a wave of his hand toward Corin. His lordship's not worth our time, boys. Let's leave him here with his servant, Cully.
Cully helped Corin carry the firewood to the wizard's tower, then left, warning Corin to avoid Bart Loman. And also warning that if Corin continued to dine at the palace like he was royalty, he shouldn't be surprised that some people, Cully included, got irritated at the special treatment. Corin hauled the firewood up the stairs in several trips, and stacked it, and added some logs to the fire in the chamber where the wizard was working. When Corin brought lunch to the wizard, he paused on his way out the door, and asked,
"Pedrus, sir, are you sure I'm not a jinx? That you're not using your wizard power to stop me from hurting people? From making bad things happen?"
"What? Of course not. What a ridiculous idea. Who told you that?"
Pedrus was a powerful master wizard. Unfortunately, he was also a terribly unskilled liar. While he spoke, he tried to smile, but the smile was not in his eyes. The frozen smile on his lips didn't convince Corin at all.
"Oh, no one. I was just wondering."
Corin knew Pedrus was lying.
"Well, you don't listen to such silly ideas, Corin."
"I won't, sir. Can I get more wood for the fire?"
"No, no, I'm fine. Are you all right?"
"Yes, sure. I'm going to eat. Enjoy your lunch, sir."
Corin went to his own room, where he sat on the bed, looking at his own plate of food, then pushed it away. He didn't feel like eating. Bart's words had stung him, because Corin knew they were the truth. Why hadn't he left, on his own, without causing his parents to be exiled from the land they owned, the successful farm they had built themselves? He had been a bad son, an ungrateful son. It wasn't his parents' fault that their son was a jinx. Tears rolled down Corin's cheeks, and he wiped them away angrily. His father had told him that moping around and feeling sorry for yourself didn't do anyone good. If you did something bad, hurt people you care about, then do something to make up for it. Or, at least, resolve not to do it again. Corin stood up, went to the wash basin, and cleaned his hands and face. Then he got changed into his best clothes, scrounged up a few coins that Pedrus had given him, and walked down the stairs. Krebs Ford had been too small, too poor to have a church. Instead, a priest had come through the town twice a year, in spring and during harvest season. The priest performed weddings, blessed people's crops and animals, and sometimes conducted a ceremony under the big oak tree in front of the golden trout, if the weather was nice. Corin's parents had only brought him into town twice to see priests. He remembered the first priest was an old man, who seemed tired, bored, and anxious to get on to the next village. The second priest was a cheerful young woman, who had happily blessed the Bladewell's best cow. Corin had liked her. Within the walls of the castle, on the opposite side of the wizard's tower, was a chapel for the royal family, although anyone could go there. Corin walked up the steps, pulled open one of the doors, and looked inside the cozy building. In the middle of the day, the chapel was empty.
"Hello?"
Corin called out, and stepped inside, carefully closing the door behind him. As it wasn't cold inside the chapel, someone must have a fire going in one of the side chambers. Corin had never been inside a church, certainly nothing as grand as the royal chapel. The ceiling soared high above him, and the inside of the thick stone walls were painted a cheery blue. Tall windows along both sides were made of colored glass, depicting scenes of people doing good deeds, healing the sick, defending the weak, helping each other.
Corrin walked along one wall, gawking up at the beautiful windows, until he came to a window which showed a farm family, mother, father, son, and daughter. The family looked happy, grateful for the help of their neighbors to harvest their crops. Corrin reached up and traced the outline of the sun with his fingertips. He remembered times like the one depicted in the window. Families in Krebs Ford always helped each other at planting and harvest time. Corrin backed away from the window. The sun's eyes in the painting were staring at him, following him as he moved, staring at him accusingly. It was creepy. He turned away from the window.
"Hello? Mother Furless?" He called out the name of the priest who called the chapel her home.
Corrin had met the kindly older woman once, when she had come to visit Pedras.
"Huh?"
a man's voice answered.
"What do you want?"
Whoever the man was, he sounded irritated.
I'm looking for Mother Furless, and, I have a donation for the church, sir."
"A donation, you say?"
A rather unhappy-looking, almost bald man stepped out from a side chamber, still holding a chicken leg. He finished chewing and wiped his mouth on the sleeve of his brown priest robes.
"Oh!"
Seeing Corrin, the man's face fell. A servant was unlikely to bring a substantial sum as a donation, hardly worth the priest's time.
"Give it here, boy."
Corrin was uncertain. He thought donations went into a box, but the priest held out his hand, so Corrin gave him the coins. The man frowned, bit into one of the coins to test it was real, and slipped them inside his robes.
"Mother Furless isn't here. She's out in the city this week, caring for the sick. I'm Father Grutch."
Grutch's home church lay on the outskirts of the city. He only was assigned to the royal chapel a couple times a year, when Mother Furless was called elsewhere. If it had been entirely up to Mother Furless, Grutch would stay in his home chapel, but she needed to give all the priests under her care a chance to serve in the royal chapel. Grutch wasn't unpopular only with Mother Furless. He was unpopular with his flock in his home church, and any church he'd ever been in. Faith and a desire to serve are not what had called Emil Grutch to the church as a young man. Poverty and laziness had motivated him. He was the fourth son of a merchant family that had fallen on hard times. His oldest brother would inherit the struggling business, which left Emil and his two other brothers to find their own ways in the world. Two brothers joined the army, which might have inspired Emil to follow them, except he saw how hard they worked, being outside in all kinds of weather. And then there was the danger, which did not appeal to Emil at all. When his brother Thomas was hit in the shoulder by an orc arrow and came home to recover for 3 months, Emil decided army life was not for him. Fortunately for Emil, and unfortunately for the followers of the faith, the priest in Emil's hometown was elderly and increasingly unable to manage by himself. Young Emil began helping the old priest when he wasn't working in his parents' shop. And soon the old man had taught the young man the basic points of the scriptures and the typical ceremonies of the faith. What he saw of priestly life did appeal to young Emil. A roof over your head, food provided not by your own sweat but by donations from the townspeople, respect from the people both common and royal. The work was not hard either, if you didn't want to work hard at it. Except for the part about caring for the sick. Emil didn't like that, didn't enjoy it to this day, and avoided those duties as much as possible. Before the old priest died, he had, reluctantly, for he saw no great calling of faith in young Emil, written a letter of recommendation for the young man to be trained in the priesthood. Emil had seen studying at the monastery
where he had discovered to his dismay there were only 2 meals a day, and meager ones at that, as his ticket to an easy life. As he read all the proper scrolls and said all the proper things, and did not cause trouble, the priests in charge of the monastery had not seen how they could deny him graduation and ordination as a priest. Unfortunately for Emile, he had not been as successful as a priest as he had imagined. He had to work harder than he wanted, and the ceremonies were so dull, and the ungrateful townspeople not so generous with their donations, and it seemed like there were always sick people he had to visit. Even when he was assigned to the royal chapel 2 weeks a year, donations seemed to be significantly less than what Mother Furless had told him was customary. So, Father Grutch was in even more of a bad mood than usual when Corin interrupted his lunch. And then Grutch looked more closely at the young man who had given such a pitiful donation.
"Oh, you're the wizard's brat."
Wizards were a particular source of irritation and jealousy for Father Grutch. Just because wizards could touch, influence, and command the spirit world to affect the world of the living, ordinary people thought wizards were so powerful. Lies. Priests, Grutch told any and all who would listen, guided people's souls to their reward, the spirit world. And wasn't that more powerful and more useful than the silly tricks wizards played with their skills? Especially since, Grutch hinted darkly, many, many wizards used their power for evil purposes, and even the best of them used foul, dark magics that were forbidden. Corin bowed fearfully. This priest didn't seem very nice.
"Yes, sir. Father Grutch, I'm Lord Salva's servant."
The mention of the word Lord made Grutch almost bite his tongue. How did a wizard merit the title Lord when a dedicated servant of God like Emile Grutch only had the humble title of Father? Grutch looked back at his lunch, which was growing cold already.
"What did he send you here for, boy?"
"Oh, begging your pardon, sir, but the wizard didn't send me. He doesn't know I'm here. I came, you see, for spiritual guidance?"
Corin wasn't sure those were the right words.
"I want to know if a person can really be cursed, sir, father."
Now this might be interesting enough to interrupt lunch.
"Spiritual guidance? You came to the right place, boy. I am a graduate of the Siurden Monastery, and am an expert in the scriptures and the eternal mysteries."
Grutch didn't know which mysteries were the eternal ones, but it sounded impressive.
"Come with me."
Grutch walked back into the side chamber, where he had been eating lunch, and put the lunch plate on top of the stove to keep warm. He was about to wipe his hands on his robe when he realized that was not quite the way to impress the boy, so he splashed some water on his hands and dried them properly with a towel. Grutch draped the official's scarf of his office around his shoulders and waved Corin to sit opposite him.
"What is troubling you, child? You can unburden yourself to me. You are safe in this house of the faith."
Corin, having never been in a chapel, was impressed and intimidated. The priest was doing his best to appear kind and caring, but his expression was severe.
I want to know, can a person be cursed? Could a person be cursed to be a jinx, for example? To jinx other people and cause bad things to happen, by accident?
Even in his little church on the outskirts of the city, Emile Grutch had heard a vague rumor about something being strange with the wizard's new servant boy. A rumor whispered in confidence by another priest who wasn't supposed to say anything.
"This cursed person, this jinx, Is this a friend of yours, or is it you? Come, speak and speak the truth. You cannot hide truth from God, boy.
Corin's mouth was dry.
Oh, sir, father, it's me, sir. You see, strange things have been happening around me since I was little. Sometimes bad things. Lord Salva, says there's no such thing as jinxes.
Of course there are. Why else would we have the word jinx in our language?
Grutch interrupted.
Continue, boy.
I don't mean for bad things to happen, and I don't do anything. Bad things just seem to happen when I'm around.
And when did these bad things start? What is your earliest memory of these jinx things?
This was more interesting than Grutch had hoped. He had, for the moment, forgotten about his lunch. Corin thought back.
I guess when I was 5 or so.
Corin listed some of the worst jinx incidents, ending with him destroying the grain mill.
Yes, yes. And did you do something bad at that time, the first time you realized you were a jinx? Steal something? Or disobey your parents, perhaps?
Oh, no, sir. Not anything like that.
Grutch leaned forward, his face very stern.
Think and answer truthfully. God does not curse people unless they have been wicked. What did you do?
Corin felt tears welling up in his eyes. He searched his memory.
That was about the time my parents wanted to have another baby. I remember my mother said she'd like a daughter, but I told her that I wanted a brother to play with and to help with my chores around the farm.
Father Grutch shook his head slowly. You wicked, wicked boy. How could you be so selfish to go against your dear mother's hopes for a daughter? And all because you were so lazy that you wanted someone else to milk the cows and harvest the crops.
Corin bowed his head in shame.
I didn't mean it.
Come now, you meant it at the time, didn't you?
One of the few things Father Grutch actually enjoyed about his job was reprimanding and punishing the wicked. And there were so many wicked, particularly among the people unfortunate enough to belong to his little church. The parts of the scriptures about God's righteous vengeance, although those were only the smallest part of the spiritual teachings, were Grutch's favourite parts to read.
I guess so. Yes,
Corin said in a whisper, unable to look the priest, the representative of God, in the eye.
God has cursed me.
What do you think, boy?
Grutch flashed a quick grin before the boy could see. Clearly the boy was cursed. How else could he be a jinx and have all those bad things happen around him?
There was no other explanation. What can I do to lift the curse?
Oh, there's nothing you can do. God's will is not like a debt you can pay, boy. You don't bargain with the Almighty. You are going to be a jinx, and a curse, and a danger to all around you, until and if God determines you have been punished enough. And that may not happen in your lifetime. What you can do is try to be good from now on, and not give God reason to curse you more and punish the people around you.
Yes, sir, Father Grutch, sir. Sir, could Pedrus Lord Salva help me?
Mention of the wizard's name angered Grutch.
No! You think wizards are more powerful than mere priests because of their silly magic tricks?
No, no, sir, Corin stammered.
You best not, boy.
The priest's voice thundered righteously. Look to wizards for useless potions and silly tricks and smoke and lights. Look to a priest when you fear for your soul, boy. Your master wizard may be able to stop your jinx from hurting someone, if he is lucky, and is there in time, and sees what is happening.
Grutch wasn't exactly clear on how jinx curses worked, but they had to be powerful.
But it cannot help you lift your curse.
Grutch sniffed and leapt to his feet. His lunch was burning on the stove. He raced over, scorched his fingers on the plate, shouted some very unspiritual words, and used the hem of his robe to lift the plate onto the table. The scent of the food reminded him of his hunger. His interest in the boy's curse was satisfied.
"Begone, boy. Think on your sins. Repent and try to follow the path of righteousness. And remember, what is said in this chapel, in this holy house of God, between a priest and the faithful, is private, and not to be repeated to anyone. Especially not to a wizard."
Chapter 6. "Oh!" Ariana exclaimed, as she pulled the neck of her dress up to cover her mouth and nose.
"What is that smell?"
The princess, with her guards and maids, had been crossing the palace courtyard when there was a muffled explosion from the wizard's tower and a burst of green light. Explosions and lights coming from that tower were not unusual, to the dismay of the residents of the castle. What was unusual was the thin, sickly, greenish mist that poured down from the windows, and the mist smelled terrible. Like as if some very large, stinky beast had died in the tower several days ago, and someone had unwisely just opened the door. Or that same large beast had eaten something that didn't agree with it, and had the worst case of gas ever. Her maids began choking on the mist, and her guards, coughing and choking, grasped her arms to hustle her away to safety when she saw the wizard and Corrin stumble out of the tower's doorway into the courtyard.
"Wait!" she ordered her guards. "Help them!"
The wizard, on his knees and choking, pulled a wand from inside his robes and gasped out words in a language Ariana didn't understand. The mist stopped pouring from the windows, but it was too late. Tendrils of the mist had reached across the courtyard into the palace, and people were already running out into the courtyard, pinching their noses and looking around in disgust. The guards helped Pedrus and Corrin to their feet, and the party staggered across the courtyard, gagging and coughing, to climb the stairs inside the wall that ringed the castle. Higher was better, as the heavy mist tended to cling to the ground. When they reached the top of the wall and could stick their faces into the wind that blew from the west, everyone hung over the wall, gasping for breath, trying to keep their stomachs from rebelling.
"Lord Salva,"
Ariana managed to say.
"What happened?"
She glanced down into the courtyard to see people frantically rushing around, trying to get away from the stench. She almost laughed when she saw Charles Fusting, the palace's chief of protocol, attempting to keep his dignity by striding stiffly rather than running, and holding a handkerchief over his mouth. But then the breeze swirled a thick tendril of mist across the man. His eyes bulged, and he ran in panic, tripped over his own feet, and fell into a puddle. Pedrus paused to catch his breath. "Brewing a healing potion, or I thought I was." The wizard's eyes narrowed, and he turned angrily to his servant.
"Corrin, are you certain that was leaves of arrowroot that you brought?"
"Yes, and they ground it up real fine, like you said,"
Corrin replied fearfully. Growing up on a farm, he was used to being around unpleasant smells sometimes, but he'd never even imagined anything smelling as bad as that mist. Had the foul mist been caused by his jinx?
his curse.
A single narrow silvery leaf with serrated edges?
Corin shook his head. No, that's a spearleaf tree. Arrowroot leaves are dark green and shaped like a triangle with smooth edges.
Pedras